Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. We're going to be spending some time talking about the theology behind the ABC TV special, Peter Jennings special, Jesus and Paul. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. He's been kind enough to join us for an entire hour and give his reaction and his arguments against some of that theology that you saw played out for us Monday before last on ABC television. If you'd like to join us during this conversation with a question or a comment for Dr. Montgomery, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Do Jesus and Paul, do they have two different religions? Is Jesus just basically the kindly, tolerant rabbi, simple in his teaching, never made much of himself, but talked about universal love, the fatherhood of God? Would have had no impact, in fact, if you watched the ABC television special, had not Paul come along and decided to invent this thing called Christianity, to take what Jesus said and endow it with more meaning than Jesus ever would have intended, to start talking about the crucifixion as victory rather than defeat, to talk about the resurrection of the dead, to give universal scope to the obscure teachings of this obscure man, Jesus. Is that how it went? Is that what Christianity really is, a product of Paul's mind rather than the life of Jesus Christ? Those are some of the questions we're going to be answering during this hour of Issues, etc. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. He's Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's a distinguished professor of apologetics and history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and he is author of more than 50 books, including The Suicide of Christian Theology. Dr. Montgomery, thank you so much for joining us again.
You're most welcome. It's always a pleasure.
Dr. Montgomery, it seems as though among liberal scholars for the last several decades, Jesus was the subject, the quest for the historical Jesus. But now, Paul is all the rage among liberal scholars. Why is that?
The figure of Paul is of tremendous importance in the New Testament. I mean, he's the author of more books of the New Testament than any other single person. And therefore, obviously, if you're going to engage in a critical dismembering of traditional Christianity, you can't leave Paul out. He's going to become the direct object of your analysis.
In that sense, is it not only necessary if you want to, as you say, dismember Christian theology to take on Paul, but is Paul is it a way that the scholars can say, look, we're not going after Jesus. We're not going after Jesus. We got no problem with Jesus. It's this Paul character that we think really has messed things up.
Well, that may well be a factor. C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letters made the point that always in revolutions, you don't begin by attacking the king. You begin by attacking his ministers. The king is all right. The trouble comes from the ministers. They have perverted what he was really trying to do. That's probably a factor in this as well.
Could you describe in a nutshell the theology that the viewers in the United States saw at work in the Peter Jennings special, Jesus and Paul, in particular the presupposition that Jesus was simply a rabbi of no real report, but Paul is the real founder of Christianity?
Well, I hope that listeners in the United States have come to understand that Jennings is no theologian whatsoever. He is a greasy journalist who is using religion to get an audience. Really, over here in England, there is the strange idea that if you're going to do a television program on religion, you really ought to be a specialist in religion. You ought to have some background in theology and know what you're doing. In the United States, I suppose, the idea is that that because of democracy, any idiot can make an authoritative statement on any subject, and you're supposed to pay attention to it. Jennings' stuff is really trivial. The position that he takes in splitting Jesus and Paul goes back to the 19th century. The so-called Tübingen School, that's T-U with an umlaut B-I-N-G-E-N, for the city in Germany where the university is located, not too far from Stuttgart, the Tübingen School argued at the end of the 19th century that the simple Jesus was perverted by the theologically inclined Paul. So they tried to divide the New Testament into the moralistic material in the Gospels concerning Jesus and the appallingly theological technical material that Paul produced. This Tübingen school view has been entirely destroyed. I mean, in all subsequent theology, it's been pointed out that the book of Acts in the New Testament shows that Paul was accepted by the original disciples. They had a choice. When he came to them as a persecutor, as Saul, they could have thrown him out into the street, but they accepted him as genuinely an apostle to the Gentiles, that he had been called, and he was on a level with them. And indeed, he corrects Peter on the matter of circumcision. Now, if that's the case, then there is no way in the world that the theology of Paul can be contradictory to the theology of Jesus. Had that been the case, the original apostles who had been with Jesus for a three-year period would have been the first to recognize it.
Let's hear the claim, this basic assertion you've described there, as it was made on the ABC television special, Jesus and Paul.
If you are to reflect upon who founded Christianity, it wouldn't be Jesus. If you have to find one person who is the founder of Christianity, that person is Paul.
Now, Dr. Montgomery, you say they're simply dredging up a discredited view from the early 20th and 19th centuries?
Well, I'm sorry to say that that's the situation. But, you know, it's important that your listeners recognize that liberal theology's big problem is not so much its unbelief. Its big problem is its dreadful scholarship. If you go to the Interpreter's Bible, for example, which unfortunately is in practically every public library in the United States, you get a liberalism, a discredited liberalism that goes back to the 19th century. And yet, across the country, there are Methodist preachers and United Church of Christ preachers and liberal Presbyterians and liberal Lutherans who are presenting this stuff as if it were competent scholarship. It can't possibly be. I mean, for 2,000 years, the New Testament has been regarded as a unity. And as I just said, the book of Acts firmly cements Jesus and Paul by way of the acceptation of Paul by the original apostles.
Now, that flies in the face of some of the assertions in a more detailed manner that were made during the ABC television special, Jesus and Paul. Here's another more detailed assertion about the supposed cleavage between Paul and Jesus.
Do you think that Paul ever embellished or distorted the original message of Jesus?
I'm sure he did. He would have to. He was a human being. And I think like any preacher worth his or her salt, he probably added a little hyperbole here or there, did a little exaggeration. And that's all right. He was a human being.
Almost makes it sound like it was a virtue that Paul was exaggerating Jesus' claims here, Dr. Montgomery.
The idea that if you're human, you've got to exaggerate is what? It's a sort of corollary to err is human, errare humanum est. But as a matter of fact, you don't have to err because you're human. If you go to Euclid's geometry, you'll find that there's not a single error in Euclid's geometry. It is thoroughly sound logically. There isn't an error in the thing. You don't have to err, but the real issue is whether or not Paul did err. And, you know, the person who made that statement was not around at the time. And the only basis for saying that Paul exaggerated what Jesus said is that Paul doesn't put things in exactly the same terms Jesus did, but that's not exaggeration. The issue is whether there's a contradiction between the two. And in Jesus' teaching, you find every single fundamental notion that you get in Paul. Paul simply gives a theological explanation of what Jesus said. For example, his name is Jesus, right? He's given the name Jesus at his birth because he shall save his people from their sins. And he is Emmanuel, God with us. And Jesus says that he comes to give his life a ransom for many. You get the notion of salvation by grace through faith. the notion of substitutionary atonement in what Jesus said. You don't have it spelled out theologically, but you have precisely the understanding which Paul then develops along utterly consistent lines later on.
What is the fundamental view among the liberal scholarship that we saw at work on in this Jesus and Paul special? What's the fundamental presupposition about not only the authority of Scripture, but the historical accuracy of Scriptures, in particular, the gospel accounts?
Well, the Jesus Seminar people and those who go along with that sort of thing assume that the material that we have in the New Testament, the Gospels in particular, consists of edited material which doesn't give any necessarily historical picture of Jesus himself. The idea is that a later generation, the second or third generation church, took traditions and molded them so as to reflect their own developed theological beliefs. And therefore, the writings of the New Testament present a number of different theologies, all of them that tell you about the early church, but none of them necessarily tell you about Jesus himself. And Paul, of course, is supposed to represent one of those major streams, perhaps the major stream. The trouble with this approach is that the gospel writings are so early and were in circulation so early that there was no opportunity to alter the picture of Jesus that was presented by the original apostles. And that's the reason why the New Testament writings are, in fact, sound history. They are not a later interpretation, perversion, development of what was originally set down. And we have absolutely no textual evidence of any kind of alterations along this line. What the liberals do is to read the New Testament, and they find what they consider to be stylistic differences and contrasts that they would not have put into this stuff had they written it. But all that says is that they shouldn't have written it in the first place, and God didn't choose liberal theologians to write the New Testament, probably for that reason.
According to the view held by those liberal theologians, if you cannot trust the gospel accounts to give us an historical account of the life or ministry or words of Jesus, where do you go then to get to the real Jesus, according to their view?
They have no route to the real Jesus at all. And that's evident from the fact that the Jesus Seminar has a system of voting for which passages in the New Testament represent what Jesus actually said, but there's no agreement even on that. The fact of the matter is that if you take that route, you don't have any Jesus left, or you have a Jesus who simply reflects your own prejudices, or who's a reflection of your own church tradition, and the end result of this, of course, is the collapse of Christianity as such. Christianity rests only upon a Jesus whose life and teachings can be known solidly and can be relied upon so that you can have faith in him. If you don't have that, you end up with faith in yourself. And last we heard, that's never been the route to salvation.
Where do the liberal scholars place Paul? How far removed from the person they would consider to be this unfindable historical Jesus? How far removed and how late in history do they put Paul and his writings then?
Well, of course, the irony of that is that Paul's writings are earlier than most of the gospel material. So the difficulty is that if they are correct that Paul is saying something that is different from what you get in the gospels, presumably there'd be more reason to rely upon Paul than there would be on gospel materials which they consider to be a couple of generations after Paul. But their view is that in the Gospels you have Jesus as a kind of Jewish Boy Scout helping little old ladies across the Sea of Galilee. He is the kind Rotarian of the first century, right? an unjudgmental sweetness and light type, and ends up crucified because he is so terribly good that he makes everybody else feel embarrassed. Whereas in the Pauline writings, you have Jesus as God Almighty, come to earth to die for the sins of the world. He rises again. Salvation is by personal faith in him. In Paul, you get the theology which has driven the church forward through its entire history. And, of course, that's what bothers the Jesus Seminar and these people, because if you want to be a theologian today, you've got to be original. And how can you be original if you simply go along with what has always been maintained? So what they're trying to do is to create a different kind of Christianity that's modeled on a humanistic naturalism instead of on the doctrinal truth that you find, as a matter of fact, both in Paul and in Jesus.
We're talking with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery about the liberal theology behind the ABC television special Jesus and Paul. Dr. Montgomery, let's listen to the discussion made on that special, Jesus and Paul, on whether or not Paul was a moralist. I'd like your reaction afterwards.
Paul can be very hard on those who do not follow his rules for good behavior. I wrote to you not to associate with anyone who bears the name of brother, he says. If he is guilty of immorality or greed or is an idolater, a reviler, a drunkard, or a robber, not even to eat with such a person. In the same letter, he says, drive out the wicked person from among you.
So he was a Puritan or moralist or...
Very strong moralist. No adultery. No divorce. If divorce, very slow on the remarriage, please. Better not.
Paul, no homosexuality now. Boom. You know, God has given them up to their depravity. You know, no homosexuality. None of that. Women, shut up. If you need to know what's going on in the church, ask your husband. Slaves, be obedient to your masters in all fear and trembling. Yeah, these problems.
Those are problems for you in the modern church, is that
correct? Well, these represent problems for many in the modern church, so to speak, yes.
What do you do when you come upon something like that?
Well, you have to say what you believe. That Paul was simply an apostle. He wasn't Jesus. And
that's the way you get around it.
Well, you've got to. Would Christ reject a homosexual? I don't think so. Would Christ tell a woman to be silent, particularly when many of the interactions of Jesus was with women that he liberated? Whether it was the prostitute, so to speak, caught in adultery, or whether it was the woman at the well. You know, what are you saying, Paul?
Dr. Montgomery, your reaction to those arguments?
Well, I find the Southern accent fairly sickening, apart from the content, but I suppose that that's not politically correct to make the point. Why do I suspect that the person doesn't have a decent education? I don't know. Anyway, the difficulty with this is that Jesus was as strict on morality, if you want to put it that way, as Paul, in every respect. In fact, Jesus has far more to say about hell and damnation than you find in the Pauline writings. Jesus said to the adulterous woman, for example, go and sin no more. He had absolutely no toleration for sin. He had a great deal of compassion for the sinner. But that's true also in the Pauline writings. Paul speaks with the common people, and he is not in any sense an intellectual snob or an individual who is out there condemning people. Look at him with Lydia, the purple seller, for example. He preaches the gospel to her with as much compassion and concern as he does to King Agrippa or the Roman governor Festus. These contrasts are really lowbrow and stupid. Where it comes to issues like homosexuality, the fact of the matter is that all of Scripture condemns homosexuality. It's regarded as the human equivalent, social equivalent of idolatry in relation to God. It's misunderstanding the very nature of things. We're to worship God and not ourselves, and we're to maintain sex relationships only with between male and female as God has created us. as far as what keeping silence and this old criticism that Paul is a male chauvinist. If you go to Ephesians 5, which is the passage in which women are told to subject themselves to their husbands and all that, that happens to be preceded by verse 21, Ephesians 5:21, which says that we should submit ourselves one to another in the fear of God. So the wife's submission to the husband is not in any way unilateral. I mean, it's a submission that also has to take place between the husband and the wife. This is a two-way street. And so the people like the gentleman that you have just quoted there or put on the radio are presenting a superficial understanding of what goes on in the New Testament. It seems to me that if we work with the New Testament, what we need to do is to read it carefully to see what the authors are actually saying. And Paul should be given the benefit of the doubt, as any writer should. And to arrogate that in a superficial, stupid manner is just to show one's own inadequacy in handling any kind of literary material.
With only 1 minute before we go to this first break, Dr. Montgomery, does the conclusions drawn by such liberal scholars on this program, do they tell you more about the scholars themselves than about Jesus or Paul?
Well, they certainly do. And what they say is, for heaven's sake, don't go to a theological seminary for instruction where people like that are the teachers. That's what it says.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. We're talking about liberal theology and the Apostle Paul, in particular, the theology behind the ABC television special Jesus and Paul, wherein Jesus is depicted as the well-meaning and obscure rabbi upon whom Paul exaggerates and invents this thing we now call Christianity. If you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, had some time to think over what you saw a couple Mondays ago on ABC television, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We also have a live in-studio email address you can use. It's issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. He's Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England, French advocate, barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. He's authored and edited more than 50 books, including The Suicide of Christian Theology. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, our conversation continues. I invite your phone calls during this break. We'll be talking about another assertion that was made on the Jesus and Paul special, the one that says Paul wasn't about doctrine. People then took Paul and made doctrines from what he wrote, but he was not about doctrine. He was about charity. He was about life. And we need to answer this question. Was Paul himself anti-Semitic? That's another assertion that is played with in the Jesus and Paul special. We'll talk about all of that when we come back with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production, salaries, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues, Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues, Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues, Etc.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Car donations are an important part of charity fundraising and a nice tax break for donors. But Washington is considering some changes in tax law that will affect those contributions. and charities are concerned. Keith Peters has the story.
It all started when a government accounting office report noticed a big disparity between the value of cars claimed by contributors and the proceeds received by charities. Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa is working on a plan that, in his words, would level the table.
It's pretty simple. Have a car given to the charity, have the charity sell it, take the money that the car brings in, notify the taxpayer of the amount of money. What could be any more simple than that?
But Pat Reed of Independent Sector, a group representing a coalition of charities, worries that the proposal in the Senate would limit the deduction that a donor could take to the price that a charity was able to sell it at.
And that really leaves donors very vulnerable to the vagaries of the auction market on any given day and the skill of the charity in disposing of the vehicle.
The uncertainty could cause contributors to decide not to donate. Bottom line, she says, people and government agencies need to be responsible.
We certainly believe that the IRS needs to do a better job of providing guidance to taxpayers and enforcing the law, and donors need to be responsible and not claiming that their car is a Cadillac when it's really a very used Chevrolet.
She hopes that government and charities can come up with a solution that would continue to provide incentives for people to donate. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters in Washington.
Pat Reed also says a Bush administration plan requiring an independent appraisal might be workable. The proposal asks donors to get the vehicle appraised or use a formula for the tax donation provided by the Treasury Department. Independent Sector was concerned enough about the issue to compose a letter to Treasury Secretary John Snow about the plan. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Did you know that over 80,000 children were reported to be abused or neglected in Missouri last year? Do all you can to protect them. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. Family Resource Center invites you to support the work they do to prevent and treat child abuse by participating in the 12th Annual Family Fest and Walk Run for Kids on Sunday, April 25th in Tower Grove Park from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. If you'd like more information, call the Family Resource Center.
How does worship heal anxiety, guilt, loneliness, and grief? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April deals with worship and healing. It's titled, They Will See His Face. You can find out more by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. The cost is $12.99 plus shipping and handling, or you can browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Just click the What's New section. The title of the book, They Will See His Face.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery about liberal theology, the theology behind the ABC television special several Mondays ago, Jesus and Paul. If you saw it, I invite your questions and comments, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, our guest, has authored and edited over 50 books, including one called The Suicide of Christian Theology. Now, you can get this book for your very own by visiting the website for the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy. That website address is www.ciltpp.com, www.ciltpp.com. You can also call them at area code 780-461-3076, 780-461-3086. Dr. Montgomery, there were several assertions made, and we're asking for your reaction to each one of these, but there was another assertion made on the Jesus and Paul special that Paul was not about doctrine.
What I like about Paul is that he is not interested in doctrines. The churches over the centuries have constructed, hewn out of St. Paul's occasional writings, cast iron doctrine. All this is mistaken. Paul is caught up with the notion of living properly. And with, above all, I think if we look to Paul, the whole emphasis on charity, on respect, on loving kindness as the way to find the divine.
Dr. Montgomery, your reaction to the assertions made there?
Well, yes.
again, I repeat what I said before. This kind of thing comes from a selective contact with the New Testament and no careful reading of it. Let's take, for example, the book of Romans. The book of Romans, as commentators have pointed out through the centuries, is divided into two sections. There is the section from chapter 1 through chapter 11, and there is the section from chapter 12:1 on to the end. Now, from 12:1 on to the end, there are ethical principles set forth. Chapter 12 starts, "I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service, and be not conformed to this world," etc. Now, the operative word there is therefore. "I beseech you, therefore, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice." The therefore refers to what has been presented doctrinally in the first 11 chapters. There, Paul sets forth fundamental Christian doctrine, and it's on the basis of the fact that, as he points out in the first three chapters, that the whole race is in sin, the Gentiles having gone against their conscience, the Jews having gone against their own law, and Christ having come, chapter 3, Christ having come and died for us so that we can be saved by grace alone through faith. It's on the basis of all of that that we have the moral teachings in chapters 12 and following. Paul, throughout all of his writings, starts with the doctrinal foundation. He presents the theology. He presents Christ's death for our sins, his resurrection for our justification. He presents salvation by grace through faith alone. And as a result of this, since we've been redeemed by Christ, then we're in a position to become little Christ to our neighbor and serve others in a matter of in an ethical and moral fashion. For whoever this person is that you just cited on the program, for that person, apparently, sweetness and light is the essence of Paul, and morality floats free of any kind of doctrinal foundation. This is impossible. You can't get to that on the basis of these writings at all.
Dr. Montgomery, there seems to be a system at work. Jesus never intended to be interpreted the way Paul interpreted him, and Paul never intended to be interpreted the way the church interpreted him. I wonder how far you can extend that.
Yes, it's very interesting. It's a sort of contemporary deconstruction. The idea is that nobody should be understood the way they intend to be understood, and we need somebody to come along and tell you what they really mean. Of course, the problem with this is that it's an infinite regress. I mean, if I were in contact with the people who are on these programs, I would say to them, "I'm sorry, but I don't think that what you're saying means what you think that it says."
Yeah, that would be a pretty simple retort. There's another issue that's raised in this Jesus and Paul special by Peter Jennings. It's the question of whether or not Paul was anti-Semitic. Let's listen to this.
In one of those letters written to a small Christian community in Galatia, in what is now modern Turkey, Paul is so critical and so nasty about those people who have been contradicting him that he is portrayed 2,000 years later as being positively anti-Semitic. In fact, it is Paul's language that gets him branded as the first Christian anti-Semite, interpreted as the voice of Christianity's rejection of Judaism.
From a Jewish perspective, Paul is the apostate. He's the one who leaves Judaism. He's the one who can be, for many, who's credited with being the first true anti-Semite, you might say, and leads to the history, to a horrid history of Christian brutality, hostility, and eventually organized persecution against Jews.
Your response, Dr. Montgomery?
Well, I don't think it should require a great deal of emphasis to point out that objecting to Judaism is not the same as being anti-Semitic. Objecting to Judaism is to say that that particular philosophy or that particular religious viewpoint doesn't happen to be sound. That doesn't make a person anti-Semitic. I mean, Paul was a Jew himself, for goodness sake. If let us say, I criticize a Scottish philosopher, does that mean that I am against the Scots? If I think that there's something the matter with French existentialism, does that mean that I am anti-French and would boil French in oil or send them to death camps? I mean, the logic there is just utterly foolish. What Paul objects to in Judaism is that Judaism made a religion out of law and took the law of the Old Testament, along with all of the traditions and excrescences of Jewish tradition, and said that if you follow this, you can satisfy God and get to heaven. And Paul says, listen, nobody gets to heaven through satisfying God because all have fallen short. All have sinned. The Gentiles have sinned, as we said, as a result of not following the law written on their own hearts. And the Jews, in their Judaism, have perverted the purpose of the law. The purpose of the law was to cause us to see that we couldn't save ourselves and therefore to prepare us for the coming of Messiah. So Paul is against that false interpretation of the Old Testament on the part of certain Jews of his time. But that hardly makes him anti-Semitic. And I just out of curiosity, have all of those segments that you've been quoting, have all of them come from the same program?
Yes, they've all come from exactly the same three-hour
program. Great heavens! And people have been watching this trash?
Apparently, yes. It actually garnered some pretty hefty ratings during its time slot.
I suppose so. There are also rock stars that can get ratings, correct? By eating garbage or dismembering rabbits. I mean, this stuff is utterly off the wall.
Picking up on something that was said in the previous cut about the book of Galatians, for which Peter Jennings faulted St. Paul as an anti-Semite, there was also the question dealt with during this, to add insult to injury here, Dr. Montgomery, there was also a question of whether or not Paul's writings to the Church of Galatia led to evil.
This letter to the Galatians has made Paul a favorite saint of the worst Christians in history. From the monks of the Spanish Inquisition to the people who carried out the 20th century Holocaust against the Jews in Europe, all those, including Hitler, who have claimed that Christian theology made it imperative to destroy Jews and Judaism.
Dr. Montgomery, I must ask...
Is that Jennings himself?
Yes, yes.
The man ought to be locked up. There's no question about this. A person like that running around is a danger to civilized society. You know, in the law, there is an action for defaming the dead. And what he has done there is to engage in out-and-out defamation against Paul. Wait, there's no way in the world that the book of Galatians is connected in the slightest with the Spanish Inquisition.
One gets the impression from his comments there that one could find Adolf Hitler on a summer's evening in his villa reading through the book of Galatians and planning the final solution.
Yes, actually what he was doing was reading pagans like Nietzsche, huh? And the kind of people that apparently Jennings has much more affinity with, humanists, people who have no transcendental basis for anything. I mean, the book of Galatians hasn't got a wisp of anti-Semitism or inquisitional character.
Well, the real issue of the book of Galatians from the outset seems to be with Paul keeping the gospel message, the message of salvation by grace through faith for the sake of Christ alone, pure as opposed to diluting it with human works. Why do you think it is the liberal scholars, and of course we could include Jennings in there if we want to, the liberal journalist, why do they fail to see what Christians for centuries upon reading the book of Galatians have seen in perfect clarity?
Well, I think the reason for this is simply that Christianity, historic Christianity, in the Pauline writings, etc., maintains the impossibility of human beings saving themselves. It insists that the starting point is to recognize that we cannot save ourselves and that we are desperately in need of salvation, and that can only come from outside of ourselves, from God's entrance into history, dying for us, rising again. In other words, Christianity starts at the point where we're willing to admit our total inadequacy. Okay, now, the contemporary theologian takes exactly the opposite approach. He wants to be the center of everything. He wants to create a theology in which human beings, by one means or another, are able to save themselves, maybe through higher criticism and clever scholarship, maybe by moralism, wrapping bundles for the Red Cross, engaging in political crusades and campaigns, this sort of thing. There are an infinite number of ways that human beings have tried to save themselves across the centuries, and every religion other than Christianity takes that approach. Liberal theology is simply a repristination of the pagan idea that we can save ourselves. So, obviously, nothing could be more offensive to liberal theology than what you get in Romans and Galatians and the other Pauline writings.
That might do. That might serve as a very good answer to the question that I asked at the beginning, and that is why liberal theologians have of late made Paul the subject of their conversation.
Could be. By the way, I can't resist pointing out, as an illustration of the bad scholarship of this whole thing, the efforts made constantly to show that most of the writings of Paul were not written by Paul anyway in the New Testament. A generation ago, two English scholars, McGregor and Morton, did a book in which they claimed that by computer analysis they could show that most of the Pauline writings were not written by Paul. They fed in the style of Romans and Galatians, and then they compared the other allegedly Pauline writings of the New Testament against that standard, and they came to the conclusion that these were all written by other people. Well, then, after their book came out on the subject, some wags at Harvard fed the style of the preface and first chapter of McGregor and Morton's book into a computer and proved that all the other chapters in their book were written by other people. The point of this is that when liberal scholars try to use stylistic factors to determine authorship, they're using a purely subjective criterion that could be used against them as readily.
Another assertion made, Dr. Montgomery, on the Jesus and Paul special was that there were differing and competing brands of Christianity early on.
In Thomas, Jesus isn't the divine savior. He's more of a Zen master or a teacher of wisdom. The gospel is a collection of sayings attributed to Jesus, but never mentions his death or resurrection.
It is said in the Gospel of Thomas, whoever understands these sayings, whoever finds the interpretation of these sayings, will not taste death. That's how you're saved, according to Thomas. You encounter Jesus, Jesus the teacher. You encounter his sayings, you interpret those sayings, find the meaning in your life, and your life is changed. You become renewed and vivified thereby.
Very different from Paul.
A very different kind of gospel.
There is no one original Christianity. There's diversity from the very beginning.
The Paul vision is the most exportable, the simplest, the least demanding in a way.
Dr. Montgomery, there certainly were other Gospels, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Philip, but are their conclusions based upon the existence of these ancient pseudepigraphal writings correct?
Well, there's no evidence whatsoever that any of these other Gospels, including the Gospel of Thomas and the so-called Gnostic Gospels that Elaine Pagels has placed so much stress on, there's no evidence whatsoever that these were ever accepted by the early church as actually coming from the apostles. And that's of high significance. I mean, in the case of the New Testament writings, the church verified that these actually came from original apostolic sources. And the reason why the Gospel of Thomas and the other Gnostic Gospels were rejected was that there was no way to show that they did come from original apostolic sources. And since the doctrines of the one contradict the doctrines of the other, you're going to have to make a choice. Whoever said that on the program that you quoted is certainly correct, that you have in the Gospel of Thomas a kind of picture of Jesus as a Zen master, and you have the notion that simply by absorbing this wisdom, you are in a right relationship with God and the rest of it. And that is not at all what Paul is saying. Fine. Both of these cannot be true. Edgar Sheffield Brightman at the University of Boston University used to say that a universe in which both Christian Science and Roman Catholicism could be true at the same time would be a cosmic madhouse. And it would be even more of a madhouse if the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of John both could be maintained simultaneously, or Paul's writings plus the Gnostics. They can't be. So what we do is to choose, obviously, what has solid apostolic authority, and we reject what doesn't. And the Gospel of Thomas simply doesn't have that kind of authority.
Dr. Montgomery, we could not allow this hour to finish without letting you hear from and respond to Dr. John Dominic Cresson of the Jesus Seminar. Here is his take on the crucifixion of Jesus.
The first question is even more basic. Was Jesus buried at all? Roman crucifixion, the purpose of crucifixion was state terrorism, and the function was to leave the body on the cross for the carrion crows and the prowling dogs. It was not simply that it made you suffer a lot, it meant that you didn't get buried. That's what made it one of the supreme Roman penalties, lack of burial. As I read those stories, I feel terribly sympathetic for the followers of Jesus, because I hear hope there, not history.
Dr. Montgomery, would you like to respond to Dr. Cresson's?
Well, I didn't get that very clearly, but it seems to me he's saying that the essence of this is what, state terrorism?
Well, he said that Jesus, he was basically arguing Jesus was not buried because the Roman method of crucifixion would have left him on the cross and then probably left him in a mass grave to be eaten by dogs and crows.
I guess my comment on this would be that since Crossan wasn't there and the New Testament writers were, I believe as a historian that I'd prefer to go with the New Testament writers. Crossan for years has presented this kind of speculation as if it were historical fact. And we have no primary knowledge of the death of Jesus other than what we have in the gospel records. Either that material is sound and can be followed, or you might as well close the door on Christianity, get rid of Crossan's theology chair, first of all, and put him out to doing something constructive, like delivering mail.
Dr. Montgomery, your reaction to Dr. Crossan's sympathy or sorrow that he feels for Christians when he says, when I read the accounts of the resurrection, I read more hope than history. Your reaction?
Listen, it's nothing approximating my sorrow at listening to that kind of theology. With friends like that, we don't need any enemies at all. What we need to do is to proclaim the historic gospel of Jesus Christ as presented consistently throughout the New Testament. We need to proclaim this and leave these people to this kind of nonsense. I mean, it would be exactly parallel to a situation where in the field of medicine you have people getting together, engaging in conferences, public debates, and television programs arguing that there are no germs. Germs don't exist. And what we need to do is to operate with a totally different theory of medicine. Or in law, people saying there is no such thing as precedent. All we need to do is to think these things through and feel them through ourselves as we sit on the bench in the courts of our land. If there were idiots like that in those fields, they would be disbarred, struck off, and no one would listen to them. And in the area of theology, we've got to be more rigorous in recognizing the difference between good and bad scholarship and between good and bad theology.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, thank you again for your time and for being our guest on Issues, Etc.
Yes, my pleasure, except for having to listen to all those quotations.
Well, it will give you something to disturb your night's sleep.
Yes, yes. Here it's almost midnight. How am I ever going to get any sleep after listening to that junk?
Well, I wish you quiet slumbers and a peaceful night's rest. Just have your wife play the harp for you. I'm sure that could lull you into a peaceful slumber.
That's the answer.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States, a distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. He's author and editor of more than 50 books, including The Suicide of Christian Theology. He is also the director and professor in residence for the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, which is held annually in Strasbourg, France. Now, it is not too late to attend this summer's, it is too late to attend this summer's academy, but it's not too late to register for 2005. That's the way it works with this academy. It fills up quick. You need to be working, well, a year in advance. Now, if you'd like to have a free information brochure on the 9th Annual European Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, that's the 2005 session, simply call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172, and we will send you a free brochure, 1-800-737-0172. Now, you saw the special. You've heard Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's reaction, and as he said there at the end, it's the kind of thing that gets a person fired up. It's the kind of thing that gets a person thinking and ready to react. I'd like your reaction to anything else you heard on that special or anything you heard in this last hour as we talked with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. What did you see in that special that confused you, that concerned you, or that left you, as Dr. Montgomery was left, a bit outraged and unable to sleep? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're going to go to this break, and on the other side of the hour, your questions, your thoughts, and your reactions. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll also hear an interview with Arian Campo Flores. He's authored a story in the latest issue of Newsweek magazine titled Get Your Praise On. We'll hear from him as he did some research and reporting on Christian nightclubs. He's Miami bureau chief for Newsweek magazine. Call during this break with your reactions and your thoughts and your comments on what we've been talking about in this hour, the liberal scholarship at work. And I've got other things to talk about during open lines as well. I'll share those with you on the other side of the break. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back with the third hour of Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.